This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I think Michael Douglas had it wrong in that movie, you guys. It's not greed that's good, it's growth that's good. The lessons of today's jobs report coming up on the broadcast. And also, just because I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it, Sharknado, the interview. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 2nd of August. Good as always to have you with us. The American economy, as we have said before on this program, is a big and cumbersome beast. Lots of moving parts. Nothing happens without affecting something else. It's all just connected. Take this week. We learned this morning the unemployment rate dropped to 7.4%, but we only added a dissatisfying 162,000 jobs. You roll that in with the anemic economic growth rate of 1.7% for the whole economy that we found out about on Wednesday, and what do you got? You got an economy that can't get out of its own way. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains the jobs and growth conundrum.
To make a real dent in the jobless rate, the GDP needs to expand a lot faster. Bernard Baumol is with Economic Outlook Group.
We need to see the economy really grow better than 3%. Ideally, 4% in order for us to see a substantial pickup in hiring.
With that kind of growth, he says today's job number could double. It's one thing to talk nationwide numbers, but in tiny Springville, New York, near Buffalo, we get a peek into the manger as one job is born from economic growth. First, the growth. Several car dealerships in the region bear Carl Emmerling's name. He says buyers are back.
They're looking to get rid of their older cars because they're more confident. They're not afraid of getting laid off next week.
There's also growth at Mark's Country Store. Owner Mark Meyer only had a moment because the place was full.
Business has been steadily increasing. Sales has been going up the last couple of years.
So they're both advertising more, and that is how a new job is born.
We're hiring a new staff reporter who will work about 30 hours a week.
Proud parent Liz Schumer is editor of Springville Journal. With more ads, her weekly paper needs more stories. She wants to make that new job full-time.
Were we to further expand with more advertisers, then we would be able to bump up that reporter or add another reporter to help us do that extra work.
Multiply that job by about 250,000 every month, and we've got a real recovery. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The jobs report, of course, gets top economic billing today, but there is oh so much more to talk about from the week gone by. To do that with us, our weekly wrap, we've got Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville in New York. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government is down in Washington, the nation's capital. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Cardiff, let me ask you this. Mark's last line there about 250,000 new jobs. That is very far away, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, this was a bad jobs report, and the badness was all pervasive. Really, it shows that we've had, especially given the revisions, yet another summer slowdown. Now, it's milder than the slowdowns of the last couple of years, and it's still pretty close to the trend we've seen in the last year and a half. But that trend itself is really dissatisfying. As you said, it's inadequate, and it's not enough to get the economy accelerating the way we'd like it to.
Neela, when do we get to the point where we look at 162,000 and say, hey, this is all right, instead of, oh, man, this stinks? Because if it keeps going long enough, right, we're going to change our expectations.
That's true. I mean, this is a somewhat deceptive jobs report, too, because the unemployment rate actually fell. But that was probably because so many people left the job market altogether. In fact, the participation rate was the lowest it's been since 1979, Kai. So 161,000 jobs just won't cut it for a very long time.
All right, let's get to the root cause of the joblessness that we have in this country, Cardiff. The financial crisis we had this week, I believe it was the first individual person found liable for fraud in the entire financial crisis, Fabrice Tour from Goldman Sachs, that trader. So he did it. It's his fault.
Well, I mean, to continue on the theme, this, too, is a little bit dissatisfying. I mean, yeah, I've got limited sympathy for the guy, but it's also the case that this was a disproportionate amount of attention being drawn on one kind of poor not poor, let's call him a rich, low-ranking schlub on the Goldman Sachs hierarchy. And if anything, to me, it just makes the contrast all the more stark with the fact that the SEC and the feds generally haven't been able to get anybody else for this. They haven't gone after higher-ranking executives, and the banks have mostly been able to settle without having to admit having done anything wrong. So this, too, feels really, really inadequate.
And we come now, I think, Neela, to the statute of limitations, which starts to expire on some of these things. It's unlikely we're going to see more prosecutions.
That's right. And this case is really disappointing. I mean, the SEC caught the small fish and let the big fish swim away. And that's been a consistent outcome. Banks are able to just pay these huge, enormous sums and keep on doing what they've been doing. And that's disappointing.
Speaking of fish, did I mention Sharknado, by the way? No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
What does it say, though, that even two of the jurors after the trial was over said, we think this guy was a scapegoat. Yes, he probably broke some securities regulations, but he was a scapegoat. The jurors said that. So I think that's right.
All right. I was going to ask you guys about the next Fed chairman, but honestly, I'm just so sick and tired of talking about that. I haven't got the gas in me to do it. So
I still like the old Fed chairman, Kai. But
I think he's done. He wants to go home, and he's had a tough 8 years. Instead, we're going to talk about the budget, Neela. What is going on down in Washington? The Senate's adjourning. They are not passing the first set of appropriations bills in the Senate. And now, all of a sudden, here we are in August talking about the budget fight we're going to have in October. Hello?
And it's going to be a big one, Kai. Senate and House, when it comes back in September 9th, that's September 9th. You thought your vacation was long. No,
I didn't.
They will have 8 days to get a budget passed before a government shutdown. And then after that, later on in October, we have this whole fight over the debt ceiling. Right. So there's a lot on that calendar as soon as the House comes back and the Senate comes back. And there's not a lot of consensus on how to get it done.
Cardiff, this just goes to the whole theme of the day today, dissatisfying.
Absolutely. And by the way, we can tie this back to the first issue we talked about, jobs. I mean, we can't be too surprised. We can't be too surprised that there's been a jobs growth slowdown given the onset of the sequestration cuts, given that earlier this year payroll taxes went up on everyone. This is because of a dysfunctional Congress. I mean, that just hasn't gone away.
Politics is standing in the way of the economy right now.
Right now and for the past, you know, who knows how many years. All right, we got to go. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphaville. Have a nice weekend, you guys.
You too.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, we'll talk to you soon. On Wall Street today, more record highs by the by, but it did feel kind of dissatisfying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Along with the not as good as everybody wanted jobs report today came this, a drop in the price of crude oil, down more than a buck to something under $107 a barrel. A not quite robust recovery means less demand for energy, the thinking goes. But when you think about big oil, though, you probably think big profits, right? Some of the richest companies in the world are oil companies. So why, then, did Shell and ExxonMobil and BP report smaller quarterly earnings this week than they did compared to a year ago? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look at that.
Royal Dutch Shell, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and BP are some of the most profitable companies on the planet. But they've experienced something of a cruel summer, says Phil Flynn, a market analyst at the Price Futures Group in Chicago.
To be honest with you, these profits are very poor compared to what we're used to. They have fallen by billions and billions of dollars.
But it's not for the usual reasons, says Christopher Knittel. He directs the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy Research at MIT.
Usually we see oil company earnings move with oil prices. Here, oil prices are up, but earnings have fallen for other reasons.
Knittel says Exxon and Chevron have been hit with the rising cost of refining oil. Shell's losing money in North America, partially because of the high cost of fracking. And BP is still paying out billions for the Gulf oil spill. Turmoil in the Middle East and parts of Africa has also hit production, says analyst Stephen Schork.
The supplies coming from the likes of Nigeria are always on tenterhooks, depending on any sort of civil strife going on.
Shell gets nearly 10% of its oil from Nigeria. These production woes and higher costs will hit consumers at the pump, says MIT's Christopher Knittel.
The greater the risk of an industry, the higher the prices for that product. So it could push up prices.
Prices are already up. The average cost of a gallon of gas in the U.S. is $3.63. That's 10 cents higher than this time last year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I'd guess the frozen foods aisle isn't often a place frequented by foodies, but the makers of Hot Pockets are trying to make their frozen meat pies more appealing to today's consumers. The makeover includes slow-cooked Angus beef and buttery garlic crusts, but it's still a Hot Pocket, so how's that going to go down with the kale and quinoa crowd, hmm? Sally Herships has this one.
When was the last time you ate a Hot Pocket?
I've never eaten them, but I know them. I know the jingle. Hot Pockets.
Hot Pockets, filled with pepperoni pizza. Or
Matt Gross is editor of BonAppetit.com. Hot Pockets were a hit in the 80s for parents experimenting with a new form of fast cooking, the microwave. More recently, the brand went after a hipper crowd with pitchmen like Snoop Dogg.
Hungry kids in the crib, ma. Pocket like it's hot. Pocket like it's hot. Pocket like it's hot.
Still, the ingredients were pretty much the same until now. The brand says it's trying to adapt to changing food tastes, so it's offering new recipes like hickory ham and white meat chicken.
They've got Angus beef, but my question is it grass-fed Angus beef? Is it corn-fed?
But will the new and improved Hot Pocket appeal to the brand's core consumer?
What is the true meaning of Hot Pockets?
John Stanton teaches food marketing at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. He says, for a brand, making changes can be very risky. 70% of new brand offerings fail because customers can get confused.
7-Up positioned itself for the longest time as the Uncola.
Until the brand came out with a cola and lost customers to Sprite.
What will Hot Pockets be? Well, it has good cheese. What have I been eating for 30 years? Bad cheese?
Bon Appetit's Matt Gross says he'd like to see a Fontina and Prosciutto Hot Pocket. But even with better ingredients, there still could be a lot of skepticism about a frozen meat pie. As one listener tweeted, once a Hot Pocket, always a Hot Pocket. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, sharks and tornadoes.
You can't ask why, it's Sharknado.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, the disappointing jobs report didn't make much of an impression on Wall Street. Today, the Dow Industrials inched up a 10%, 30 points, closed at 15,658. The NASDAQ took home 0.3%, 13 points, 3689. The S&P 500 advanced a 10%, 2 points, 1709 at the close today. For the week gone by, the Dow up 0.6%, the NASDAQ gained just over 2%. The S&P 500 gained just over 1%. Airline stocks lost some lift after the State Department issued a wide-ranging travel alert. U.S. Airways descended more than 2%. Today, Delta dropped about 0.5%. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.6% on the nose. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, Congress is on summer break. In Los Angeles, Carmageddon Deja Vu, the 405 freeway off-ramp to Sunset Boulevard is shut down for 4 months for improvements. Don't live here? Well, I'm sure you've got problems of your own. And August is What Will Be Your Legacy Month? Marinate in that while you sit in traffic. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Texas, which executes more people than any other state, is facing a supply chain problem. It's running out of the drug it uses in lethal injections, pentobarbital. Texas has tried and failed to find a new supplier. Other states are dealing with shortages of drugs they use in lethal injections, too. Sarah McCammon explains why the law of supply and demand doesn't quite seem to apply here.
This isn't the first time Texas has gone looking for a new drug to execute condemned inmates.
Oh, it happens all the time. Probably two or three times in the last 5 years.
John Hurt is a spokesman for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. The state supply of the current drug, pentobarbital, has an expiration date at the end of September, and Texas can't get any more. Why not?
That's a business decision made by the pharmaceutical companies.
The decision to stop supplying drugs for lethal injections has states like Texas looking for alternatives. But so far, no one's stepping up to provide them. It's a tiny market, not worth the risk for pharmaceutical companies concerned about their reputations, says Frank Lichtenberg. He's a health economist at the Columbia Business School.
If I am selling other drugs or this drug for therapeutic uses, you know, it doesn't send a very good message to the market and to customers that this drug is also being used for capital punishment.
Besides, it's not easy to get into the business. Drug makers operate under lots of regulations. Some states, including Georgia, have looked at getting pentobarbital from compounding pharmacies. David Ball is a spokesman for the International Academy of Compounding Pharmacists. He believes at least some of those pharmacies, which mix custom medications, will provide the drugs if asked.
It's not something that compounders view as any kind of business opportunity. It's merely serving the needs of the government.
A need that's not going away as long as capital punishment is legal. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
There are tens, probably hundreds of thousands of college students out there this summer doing internships, trying to fill their resumes with real-world experience in the hopes of getting a job when they graduate. Neither jobs nor internships are all that easy to get right now, which may explain why record numbers of American students are heading to China to do their summer internships, programs that send students to China report triple-digit growth. Not all those programs, though, work out, and some go spectacularly bad. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has that story.
Keenan Madsen's internship in China this summer has taught him an important lesson.
I've essentially been homeless in China for a month, living day to day, not knowing what I'm doing. So I definitely have learned more about myself and my personal strengths as far as what I can take.
Homeless in China wasn't an item Madsen was hoping to add to his resume. It all started when he and 13 other Americans were selected by the Hong Kong America Center for its first annual South China internship program. Mark Rowland, an accounting major at Washington University in St. Louis, was another student on the program.
One of the big features of the internship was that we would be partnered with a Chinese intern, and with them we would be conducting like a bilingual research project in marketing, finance, or accounting, something that would benefit the company that we were placed with.
Roland, Madsen, and three others found out where they were going to be placed. Chimelong Paradise, China's largest amusement park in the city of Guangzhou.
So it's got a zoo, a circus, like Cirque du Soleil. It's got SeaWorld. It's like all the great American theme parks rolled into one.
Roland was a little nervous. Was this the sort of place you could do an accounting internship? He says the program officer assured him it'd be a good fit.
I was just envisioning kind of like a corporate job in their headquarters or whatever.
Keenan Madsen, who plans to major in physics, says he was told he could do an engineering and design internship at the park. But the amusement park boss had another idea. Once a group of Americans arrived, they were handed costumes and they were ordered to put them on.
Don't know if you've ever seen Mary Poppins, but when Mary Poppins goes into the dream land and Dick Van Dyke is wearing that white and red jumpsuit with the top hat, that's exactly what I look like.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious.
And that's the moment Madsen realized he had traveled 10,000 miles around the planet so that he could greet visitors at the front gate of a Chinese amusement park. His job was to wear a candy cane striped suit and collect entrance tickets for Chinese tourists.
Because I was afraid to speak when I was just a lad.
Intern Mark Rowland, the accounting major, was given a safari costume to wear. He was told he'd be working inside the park's zoo. After 2 days of this, all but one of the interns at Chime Long quit. Amusement park staff told students the South China internship program had misidentified them as hospitality students, and they were now on their own. Four American students stuck in China, homeless, crashing on the couches of other expatriate Americans who felt sorry for them.
So we were just couch surfing after we left the employee dorms.
In the end, two students flew back to the U.S., Mark Rowland left for Shanghai, and Keenan Madsen roamed around China staying with friends until the South China internship program found a new placement for him.
Was there, you know, not enough oversight? Yeah. Were there mistakes made in the initial communication process? Yes. We've already tried to address these matters.
Glenn Shive is director of the Hong Kong America Center. His center received a $200,000 grant from the Ford Foundation to partner with the United International College to run the South China internship program for 3 years. It was part of the Obama administration's 100,000 Strong initiative, which aims to bring more U.S. college students to China. Shive says he's sorry about what happened, but he says the problems could have been ironed out had the students stuck around. When you come to China to work, says Shive, the first thing you need to do is reset your expectations.
Anything that's in their minds that they have coming off the airplane to say, I'm here, I'm ready, you told me this, this, and this, and it's not there. And I'm saying this person is going to have a hard time in China.
If there's an expert on U.S. students doing internships in China, it's Jeremy Friedline. He's managed an internship program for CET academic programs for 5 years. The trick, says Friedline, is managing expectations. Even though China is the world's second largest economy, it's still very much a developing one.
In America, when you have an internship in a company, people are used to having interns, generally speaking, and they know what their end of the deal is. In China, internships are more or less just sort of free or cheap labor. And foreign companies and Chinese companies will sort of just make use of that however they want to.
Friedline says much of China doesn't yet have a culture of internships. And for better or worse, this first wave of young American interns are guinea pigs. But not if Mark Rowland could help it. After leaving the South China internship program, he tapped his university alumni network to find a real internship in Shanghai.
So I've worked there for 4 days now, and I've already done more meaningful stuff in those 4 days than I ever did at Chime Long.
And in doing so, Rowland learned the most important lesson for any foreigner living in China. Life here is a thrilling yet chaotic adventure. You'll need connections to help you along the way. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There comes a time on this radio program, funnily enough, often on a Friday, when we've had about all we can take of gross domestic product and the unemployment figures and what is or is not happening in the, you know, serious economy. Well, in times like those, we turn to things like this.
There are sharks flooding the streets.
You can't just wait here and wait for sharks to rain down on us again.
Instead of letting live sharks rain down on people, we're going to get in that chopper and throw bombs into the tornadoes.
That, for those who somehow missed it when it was on the Sci-Fi Network a couple of weeks ago, was Sharknado, a made-for-TV original film in which, just like it sounds, a tornado comes to Los Angeles and starts dropping sharks from the sky. The premise, we'll grant you, is a little bit out there, but it's become quite the pop culture sensation. In fact, it's going to have special midnight showings in movie theaters across the country tonight. Anthony C. Ferrante directed the film. He's here with us now. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. Now, and obviously for you, too. I mean, this movie, man, come on. Did you have any idea?
No one did. and everybody goes like, oh, well, you know, why did it do this? You can't ask why. It's Sharknado. It's a movie about sharks in a tornado, and it just hit everybody's, you know, sweet spot for whatever reason.
We should just stop right there. You can't ask why. It's Sharknado.
Exactly.
Tell me about the pitch process for this film. How did it work?
Well, I was brought in. Do you want to do this movie about sharks and tornado? And I wanted to do it. And so this was an opportunity to do VFX and action.
Visual effects.
And
sharks
to do comedy.
Flying through the air.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think some people go, oh, well, they don't know that they've made this movie. It's like we have Ian Ziering going into the belly of a shark and chainsawing his way out. Of course we know the movie that we're making.
What was the budget for this thing?
IMDb says it's like about $1 million. It's probably between $1 million and $2 million.
Did it feel like $1 million to you?
It definitely felt like all the money's on the screen.
Yeah.
We had jib arms. We were out in the water. We were building sets. And we had the cast that we had. So clearly we had enough resources to do enough damage to basically disturb the population for the last month.
Well, that's the thing. And I have to tell you that as I was watching this thing go by on Twitter that first night it aired, it was a little weird. It was a little culty.
It was a thing where there's all these theories. I can't say what was one thing over another. I just know that Sci-Fi did their typical commercials.
Sci-Fi Channel, yeah.
Sci-Fi Channel that aired it. They just did they do these movies all the time. They put their commercials out there. We did our own little grassroots thing. We had a Facebook page. We created a little Facebook army. The people decided to have this collective movie-going experience nationwide. So it was like everybody was in a movie theater, but they were at home. But that was not planned. There was no marketing budget for it. There was never, hey, everybody, we're going to do this. Let's do this. The public just said, let's make this happen.
Did it ever, it must have occurred to you during the making of this film that this is just a hell of a way to make a living.
I got to be on a Kodiak boat in the middle of the water going toward a fishing boat with the camera guy. I got to jump in the water playing with shark fins.
Cool.
I got to see a set built in a outdoor public swimming pool that we flooded and had sharks and blood in there.
It gets no better than that.
I mean, you're a kid. This is like when you want to make movies and you're thinking you're going to get a chance to do this, and they gave us all these toys. Making movies is hard.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was fun. I mean, think about it. If you were 12 years old and someone said, "Hey, do you want to go into someone's backyard? I got this shark thing I built. Let's have some guy chainsaw his way out and we'll throw blood on him." You would be there.
Anthony C. Ferrante. He directed the movie called Sharknado. On big screens tonight.
It'll be on my tombstone.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that this is Red Pants Friday here at Marketplace World headquarters in Los Angeles. Yes, it's usually just me taking part, but still. Anyway, somebody sent me this the other day, a study done over in the UK showing Brits don't much care for men in red trousers. Seems it's an indicator of upper class snobbishness. Words like idiot and clown were used to describe men in red, which did give me pause. But then I remembered we're not in London, are we now? All right, that's it. We're done. It's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow inched up about 0.1%. The NASDAQ took home 0.3%. The S&P 500 advanced 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.